Today is June 11th, 2009, and I'm speaking with
Bob Denny. My name is John Robert Denny, but I go by Bob.
We're speaking at OCAMIC in Gainesville, Florida. Mr. Denny, could you please tell us when and where you were born?
I was born in Carbur, Florida, which is in Taylor County. It's spelled C-A-R-B-U-R, July 29th, 1926.
And what did your father do for a living?
Well, my father had been in the First World War. He came to Florida immediately thereafter and first was settled in Jacksonville and was a real mail carrier. And then he got in the jewelry business, and he was in the jewelry business at the time I was born.
Okay. How many brothers and sisters did you
have? None.
None. Your only child?
Only child.
And your mother, was she a homemaker?
She was a homemaker. She was born in Philadelphia and came to Florida to visit her father, who was wintering in Orlando because he had asthma and he was there for his health. But my father met her and they got married and she didn't go back.
Okay. Where did you go to school?
I went to school in Trenton, Florida for 12 grades, for the first through the 12th grade, and I graduated on March the 23rd, 1944. We had an 8-month session because the money was not there to have 9 months of school.
And when did you enlist in the service?
I enlisted in the enlisted reserve corps 1 week after D-Day. It had to be June the 13th, 1944.
Can you describe what it was like to enlist? Can you describe what it was like to enlist?
To enlist?
Yeah.
Going through the enlistment?
Yeah.
Well, my folks took me to Jacksonville. We got there. There was supposed to be at a certain time. I was there on time, but apparently they had processed everyone, so I had to be processed by myself. And they'd already sent them to Camp Landing for the physical, so my folks took me by Camp Landing, and I had my physical there by myself, which was quite an experience.
Mm-hmm. Did they give you lots of injections? And
no, well, they took my blood. They took blood from my arm, and it took them four times before they found blood.
Good grief! What was your next? What was your next task after that?
Well, that was sometime. That was when I enlisted, of course, and then by the first of the month, I was given I enlisted because they told me when I was 17 they'd send me to college, and when I became 18 then I would have to go in the Army. So I went in, they sent me to the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, and I was in what they call the Army Specialized Training Reserve Program. Mm-hmm. They originally had the ASTP program, which was for those in the service, but they put this in the reserve. That you were not in the service, but you would expect to go into the service.
And you were at Alabama for one semester, you said?
One quarter. It was from July 44 through September.
And what did you study?
It was basically they geared it for engineering. They gave us a test in math, and I did excel in that, so I was in the top group, but I wasn't good in the physics and chemistry,
right?
Because I didn't understand all that. But I got through it, and I was able to bring some of those credits to the University of Florida when I actually got here to college in Gainesville.
That's good. Could you describe what basic training was like?
Well, after I got through that, I came home, then I went to Fort McPherson in Georgia, Atlanta, and then they put us on a train and didn't tell us where we were going, but as we were standing there, I heard somebody say, "Did you call Blanding?" One of the men on the spoke to another one. So I assumed we were going to Camp Blanding, and we did. So we got on a train, rode across some of the backwoods of Georgia, which I wasn't familiar where I was, ended up in Savannah. Mm-hmm. And I knew once we were in Savannah that we were headed south. On the way to Florida, the train broke down, so we were late getting to Camp Blanding, but we made it. When we got there, they gave us a test about tonal qualities of distinguishing one tone from another. And because I apparently scored fairly well on the test, I was then given training as a radio operator.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a communications area, and some did telephone, but I went into radio. And of course, we took Morse code. And there's more to that story, but I won't go into it right now.
Okay. When did you ship out?
All right. I haven't really finished the training program because while we were there, they were training us to fight the Japanese. Jungle warfare in the woods, in densely treed areas and so forth. They trained us in 50 caliber machine guns, of course, the M1 rifle, bazookas, other BARs, which are Browning automatic rifles, and grenade launchers and such as that.
So you expected to go to Japan or right, to the Pacific Theater.
Right, we were. And, however, around Christmas time, we noticed some activity one night, and what we found out was the group that was trained ahead of us were pulled off a bivouac and actually were brought back to the company area. And the reason they were brought back, they were processing them and they sent them to Europe because the Battle of the Bulge had occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And also because the Battle of the Bulge had occurred, then we were, my training was cut short. So my training as a radio operator was curtailed. And because it was curtailed, I got a certificate which says radio operator slow speed. And so then, of course, we were allowed to go home for a short time, and then I was sent overseas to Europe.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you get to Europe?
Before I left Camp Blanding, I thought, well, it's Stark, and I'll get to Stark, and I get home from Stark. However, the Army doesn't program you that way. They said, get out and get on this vehicle, and they dumped me on the streets of Jacksonville. I bought my ticket, so because they made me pay for my ticket, and I had very little cash in my pocket. So here I am, how am I going to get home? So I borrowed $3 from one of the guys from Tampa, because he was sort of the same predicament. He was heading south instead of north. So I rode the train from Jacksonville to Trenton, and then afterwards, then my folks were to take me to Stark, but my father found out. It bought me a ticket from Waldo to Stark, which is a short distance. And so actually my parents took me to Waldo to catch the train. And on the way, as I was driving through Trenton, I saw two girls that I knew, and they were headed back to school, and I was headed to overseas. And it was quite heart-rendering, I'll tell you.
Really?
And so anyway, we went and I got on the train, rode to Washington, D.C., and I had a time in Washington. And by the way, when I was there, I happened to bump into a fellow that had been at Alabama with me, Joe Duke. And when I was there, I got to go to the Capitol and the Library of Congress and see a few sites of Washington before I went on to Fort Meade, Maryland. And I was at Fort Meade, Maryland probably about a week. While I was there, I was able to catch the train and go visit my father's sisters in Wilmington, Delaware. Mm-hmm. So I went up for the weekend, spent the time with them, and then went back. And then from Fort Meade, I was sent to Camp Shanks, New York. Now, we're in New York about a week. Mm-hmm. While I was there, they chose, because they had to have a complement of unit going overseas, they designated me a saltwater sergeant, which meant that I was in sergeant only for the trip across seas, mm-hmm. overseas. During that time, I was able to go into New York. I went to see the Rockettes in Radio City Music Hall. I went to a radio show, which was the Phil Spitalny and the All-Girl Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
It was right before St. Patrick's Day, so they had a program of Irish music. And I went to the top of the Empire State Building and top of the Radio City and did the usual sights around New York, which was very pleasant before I got to go.
How did you get to Europe? Was it on a troop ship?
While we were there, of course, one day we left Camp Shanks and we were carried to the port and we got aboard the former Grace Line ship, the SS Santa Rosa, USS Santa Rosa.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was SS Santa Rosa. And we got aboard on the evening of the 14th of March, and they told us keep our windows closed because of the blackout, and we might sail that night, but when we got up the next morning, we were still sitting at the pier. So we actually left on March the 15th of 1945. And somebody remarked, because at that time, that was the day for filing your income tax.
Yeah, that's great.
However, we went in a convoy of about 50 ships, and it took us about 2 weeks to get to Europe. The night before we landed in France, we were awakened by some explosives. Apparently, they sighted a submarine, and apparently we're dropping depth charges. And an officer came by and said, "Are we awake?" We said, "Yes, we're all awake." That was the only incident that I recall on the seas. When we were on the ship, they served us two meals, and we ate in the dining room. However, we stood while we ate at a high table, and they had the regular tray-type things. And when the ship would rock, your tray might move away from you, and you had somebody else's tray in your under you to eat. But however, we got to the right tray to eat. And we ate, as I said, two meals. So basically, when we got through our first meal, we got in line to go for the second meal.
Could you describe for me your first impressions of Europe? You docked in France?
Okay. Yeah. We got in Le Havre, mm-hmm. And when we were there, there were quite a number of ships that had gotten in there. And so there are other ships who are unloading troops at the same time. So we were aboard ship and just standing, you know, watching over the side and looking. And was one fellow sitting next to us, said, "Well, my brother, he came over on his ship, and he kept looking, and finally he saw his brother get off another ship and was able to wave to him." I thought that was just awesome. And of course, we got off the ship. They took us to a warehouse building or big building and fed us. And all of a sudden, I realized I was getting on a 40-8, and which my father had ridden on a 40-8 in the First World War, and I was quite shocked to know that I was going to ride in a boxcar across France, but that's what I did. So we got on there, and because I was the saltwater sergeant, they asked me to assign someone to ride in the baggage car. So I picked myself to ride in the baggage car, which meant that there would be not as many of us there, but we'd have all the duffel bags with us. And so we rode across France, and that was quite an interesting. The first day, I think we went through the city of Amiens, and I remember seeing the cathedral there. And then as we went through the French countryside, we saw canals and rivers, and I remember my father saying he saw a canal that was actually built over a river, and I saw such a thing. Okay. Actually, you can see this waterway, mm-hmm. was built suspended, how it was over a river, but it was. Mm-hmm. The second day out, of course, we had no restroom facilities on the boxcars, and after breakfast, our body functions needed to be eliminated. And it was quite interesting for people to go and see the French toilets they had in the station.
Right.
And I won't describe those, but I think most people know what they're talking about.
Right.
We kept on, and finally, the last evening, I guess it was the second evening, we were someplace. We stopped at a station, and I saw somebody working in the train yard there. And I spoke to him, and I pointed to the ground, I said, "Alsace, Lorraine." He said, "Alsace." So I knew that we were pretty well into France. As we were going through train stations, I would see this sign, "Sortie." And I thought, oh, well, we must be in the town of Sortie. I finally found out that was the exit. No, the entrance, I guess it is. Okay. After we got there, we got off the train, and we got in trucks, and they drove us from in the trucks across the Siegfried Line. We got to see all those fortifications that had been built there, and then we went into Germany. We were in Germany, put in a repo depot or replacement depot, and I was there. I think I probably got there on a Saturday. The next day was April the 1st, and also was Easter Sunday, as well as being April Fool's Day. And that day I was issued my rifle. Somebody said, "You didn't take a rifle." I said, "No, they don't give you a rifle to take overseas with you. They don't want everybody having rifles on the ship." So I got my rifle, had to clean it on Easter Sunday. and we saw some German people dressed rather drably, but in their best dress, because it was Easter. Then during the week, our unit, the Repo Depot, moved across the Rhine. So, because the forces were advancing, so we moved across the Rhine at, and I may not be pronouncing it correctly, at Ludwigshafen in Mannheim.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were in another replacement depot there on the other side of the Rhine. And by Saturday, which was April the 7th, I was assigned to the 165th Combat Engineers.
And where did you see combat?
Well, we were really in combat then,
mm-hmm.
although you didn't. It was just on occasion you would see something that you could really call combat. In the nighttime, I was surprised they would have searchlights to light up the sky to keep for visibility purposes. And that was something new, strange to me. As we went on, we saw German jets. The first jet airplane I ever saw was a German jet. And I also observed them, the anti-aircraft units, firing at the German jets, but they missed them. I mean, they weren't used to firing at jet planes, so they never did down any of them that I saw. Apparently were strafed one time, and I think I remember, this is imagination, I heard the bullets hitting the ground, but I'm not positive of that.
Mm-hmm.
That may be just my imagination. 3 days after I was in combat, this is in the combat condition, we went through the town of Bad Kissingen, and this had been declared an open city, in which the reason was the place had formerly been a health spa city where people would go to take the waters, and they had a lot of small hotels there, so the German army was using it for recuperation for wounded German soldiers. So they didn't want us coming there killing or bombing, so they declared it an open city. So as we rode through the city, we saw German officers. They could have been medical people, but they were walking down the sidewalk in full uniform as we were driving down the streets.
Wow.
This was quite, I mean, very emotional to see that here we are, we're not shooting them, they're not shooting at us. During the progress, and we were in Bavaria, we crossed the Main River twice, and I think we were at the Main, probably the second crossing, when we got the news that President Roosevelt had died. We also got the news that Ernie Pyle died, and who was a very well thought of reporter who
mm-hmm.
was the GI reporter. We continued going down. We actually crossed the Regnitz and the Pegnitz, and then finally the Danube. During that time, we went through Nuremberg, and while we're at Nuremberg, it happened to be Hitler's birthday, so some general wanted to have a parade. Can you imagine, here we are in war conditions, to have a parade in the Adolf Hitler plots in Nuremberg? So our unit was asked to build a reviewing stand. But while we were doing it, snipers were shooting at us, so it was delayed. So the parade was not on Hitler's birthday, but the day after. And that plots now is called the Hauptplatz, the main plaza in Nuremberg. And I've been back to it, and that's another story. We proceeded on. We went to Munich,
mm-hmm.
and both Nuremberg and Munich seemed to be devastated cities. You saw no one, just destruction. But while we're in Munich, we got word about Dachau and the concentration camp there. And the orders were given that someone from every unit should go. So our medic was named St. John, and he was the company commander, asked him to go. He came back and told our company commander, "It's too much, I can't describe it." He said, "Everyone should go." So the company commander said, "We will get a truck." So the next day we went. So I got to go see Dachau. It had snowed. In fact, I saw my first snowfall on May the 1st, and this was probably about the 3rd of May.
The first ever.
Hmm?
You hadn't seen snow.
That's right, because
that.
Mm-hmm. I'm a Floridian.
Yep, right.
and I slept in a pup tent. Had to get my pup tent and set it up in the snow and also take it down in the snow, which was quite an ordeal. But I didn't think of it at the time as such. Went to Dachau. We saw the gate, and while we went inside, there was a train there of boxcars, and there must have been at least 50, I don't know how many, but the train was full of dead people. Some were sitting up, some were lying down, some had fallen out, some were under the train, and their bodies appeared to be, their backbone and their stomachs were right next to each other, just skin and bone. How they died, I don't know, whether it's starvation, the cold, or what, but they were dead. As we walked through the camp, we saw a German officer who had been killed. His body was on the ground. He apparently had been in combat, had lost a leg. So I assume he had been given an assignment to be at Dachau rather than being in battle. So, but apparently they had turned on him and killed him, and he was lying there. His crutches were beside him. His blood had mixed with the snow. So this was something that I don't think I'll ever forget. Then we went back, and we, as time went on, we got on the Autobahn in Munich, and we headed down the Autobahn towards Austria. As we got down there, of course, there was snow in the area, beautiful covered fields with snow. And as we got on the Autobahn, a bridge was blown, so we had to stop. And we stopped the Autobahn and stayed a while, and finally we found our way back. And we spent, on May the 4th, we were at a German small place, and I know some of us saw a chapel there. We went in to see the chapel. It was beautifully with gold and very beautiful inside for a small chapel. The next day, we arrived in Austria, and we bivouacked off the Autobahn in a forested area. There was a field, and that's where we were when the war ended. And actually, on the 5th of May, that night was the anniversary of the establishment of our unit, the 165th Combat Engineers. So we were celebrating the second anniversary of that. And of course, our battalion commander, Charles Schilling, he made a speech and noted the time that we had, that had been our anniversary, and we'd marked that, and here the war was not over, but here we were in Austria. The war actually got over on the 8th of May, and the time was established to be at midnight. Well, it was actually May the 8th. In the States, it was still late in the day, but the day was not over. But the day was turning there. So the Army orders came out that the time that the war would be over in Europe was at 24:01. Well, there is no such time. It's either 24, it should have been 00:01, but that's a little bit complicated. And so I guess they wanted the day to be the same, so they called it May the 8th to 2401. But as I say, there's no such time. But that was to keep the date the same in Europe as it was in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Our unit was called out to repair a road or build a bridge because they had located the King of Belgium in that area. And so I had to pull guard duty.
The King of Belgium?
The King of Belgium, Leopold.
What was he doing there?
Well, when the Germans went into Belgium, the king sort of acquiesced and said, okay, here we are, come take us. Some people thought he should have fought. Like, they thought France should fight. And France did fight up to a point, but they just folded. The way Hitler maneuvered, going into Poland and Norway and the Low Countries of Holland and Belgium. It just was unbelievable how it just all fell apart so easily. Actually, he did not realize that he was going to do it that way, because he wanted to go take England, but he didn't have the material and he wasn't able to go to England he would have gone to England, but he couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason we had fortunately, England was able to keep going in spite of the bombings, in spite of the things. And of course, we had the Lend-Lease and camaraderie between Roosevelt and Churchill, which was unbelievable. That's just another story of history. So the King of Belgium sort of cozied up to Hitler or to the German people. And so they took him, and I guess they wanted to keep him with them, so they had moved him to he was in the area of Salzburg.
Okay.
So somebody knew that. Some of the military authorities, the intelligence authorities, found out he was there, so they wanted to build. So I had to pull guard duty. So our pulling guard duty was standing on in a wooded area next to a field near the airport in Salzburg. And as the moment came, people started shooting tracer bullets, not us, but others, and the Enzensberg Mount was in the distance, and you could see these tracer bullets going up towards, it was like fireworks.
Wow.
It was a celebration. The war's over. In Europe, that is. And
how did that feel?
Well, it felt good, except we kept hearing things plopping on the ground. I don't know what it was, but we heard things falling out of the air. I guess some of the bullets were so far. So we grabbed our helmets and said, we don't want to be killed now. But anyway, and the next day we had a parade. And we went and I know the 3rd Division was in there because I met a gentleman that was in that same parade with me later in Tallahassee. Anyway, we had a parade. The Under Secretary of War, Robert Patterson, was there. So he came to the parade, and he was late. And actually, we just had to stand there and wait. And I remember I laid down on the ground and actually took a nap.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we waited about 4 hours, and finally we had the parade. Playing the Star Spangled Banner was pitiful. But I can understand that after trying to get a group of musicians together to play the Star Spangled Banner after been fighting a war, it didn't come out too well, but they did it. That was part of it, and then we just stayed there for a while, and they tried to get us. My unit, this is something I didn't tell you, but the unit I joined had 25 or 30 casualties at the time I was on the ship going overseas, and they were begging for people. What had happened, units as they moved across Europe would find houses and move into them and stay. Well, they checked this house thoroughly, but didn't know it was booby-trapped. So the house blew up, and we had probably 17 or 18 were killed, and there were probably as many more were wounded. So there were like 20 something to 30 casualties. So they were begging for people, and the fact that I had gotten overseas, they matched me up, and that's how I got to go to that unit. So our battalion commander said, we will never stay in a building. We're going to sleep in our pup tents.
I see.
So that's the reason I was sleeping in a pup tent. We were still sleeping in pup tents then. They tried to get us to barracks, but we being a smaller unit, somebody else pulled rank, and we stayed there for a month.
So it must have been cold in a pup tent.
Not really. No. We had sleeping bags that were lined with flannel and we slept in our uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't take. I think stayed in mine for a month without taking it off.
Mm-hmm.
And how I stayed clean, I don't know. We did shave, but and we washed out of our helmets. So.
Now, was Vienna in the Russian zone?
That's another story.
Okay.
Just let me. If it's not too, we don't want to jump to that too quick.
Nope,
we left there. We went to Innsbruck. Well, Innsbruck is in the Austrian Tyrol, which is Salzburg is mountainous, but Innsbruck's very mountainous and valleys and so forth. It was right north of the Brenner Pass. And the Brenner Pass we knew about because Hitler and Mussolini used to meet there at times. Mm-hmm. So one Saturday, or I guess it was a Sunday, we went down, we got in a truck and we went down to go to the Brenner Pass. Now, we were told that we should not go into Italy, but I think we were told that you could step across the border. So we did step across the border and say we were into Italy. That I went back, and that's another story, like 40-something years later, and saw the same place, the same marker. However, it was a delightful day. We saw people in their native dress and very colorful dress. While we're in Innsbruck, there was a mountain there, and I rode a cogwheel train, then a cable car, another cable car, and got up there. Then the cable car quit running, and this Florida boy with some other boys, they said, "Well, let's walk down the mountain." It was quite an experience. I won't give the details, but it was very trying, mm-hmm. because I wasn't used to walking down mountains. We stayed there for a while. Then we went back to, we left there and went back to the province of Salzburg, below Salzburg, in a town called Göhling. Mm-hmm. And while I was at Göhling, they had established a rest camp at Seefeld. Now, Seefeld is the place where they had the Olympics years ago, and I went there. I was supposed to be there for 2 days. I was there a day, and they came and said, "You got to go back where the unit is disbanding." So I went back to Göhling. And while I was there, the unit was broken up, and I was transferred to the 31st Engineers. And they were in a place in the Austrian Tyrol called Reutte, R-E-U-T-T-E. Mm-hmm. It was in the area of Austria that's near the German city of the town of Oberammergau, mm-hmm. and which is very famous. It was cold there. July was quite cool. And then stayed there. And then we moved to a bridge school on the Danube into Germany. The war was still going on with Japan. So they wanted us to keep in training. Of course, they wanted to keep us occupied. Mm-hmm. So we had the latest equipment for building bridges. They had units that put together sort of like bricks in a way, only longer. To build bridges made of aluminum. And it was quite an experience because I had never gotten into the building of bridges because I'd had infantry training. So we stayed on the Danube for about a week, and then we moved from there to a place in Austria called Redelzip, R-E-D-L-Z-I-P-F. I didn't know it at the time, but they make Zephyr beer there. Mm-hmm. There was a factory there underground, which where the Germans had made the V-2 rocket motors. Oh. And so I got to go in and see that. It was also near a place called Vöcklabruck. And Vöcklabruck was like a rail center where there were rail yards there. And the rail yards had been damaged. In fact, one of my bosses later that I met, he had bombed Vöcklabruck. Mm. So... we were there. We did not do the work, but we sort of helped the Austrians repair their rail centers and so forth. But our crews were supervisors, so we did that at Vöcklabruck.
Did you get any sense for the Russian army? Were they in the...
Just area? A minute.
Okay.
Okay. While I was there, mm-hmm. Bob Hope came to mm-hmm. Salzburg, and I got to go see Bob Hope, and that's another story, but I won't go into that. But it was quite entertaining. It was out in the open, and sort of the way the mount was shaped was sort of like a bowl, and the whole side of the mount was just covered with soldiers, GIs. I mean, it was, and of course he came on. It had been raining, and the stage was wet, so he got a broom, and the officer was sitting in front, so he took the broom and swept the water onto the officers, and we all just roared, of course. while we were in there, I said, "Oh, I'd just love to go to Vienna. I just thought I'd love to go to Vienna." One day we got orders, we were going to Vienna. Well, Vienna, like Berlin, they're both being the capitals of the country, Berlin was a divided city. Well, so was Vienna. Now, the Soviet Union had come in to Vienna, into Austria, rather, and they had taken the eastern part. We had come in to the central part. So Austria was divided up into zones. The most western part was given to the French. The eastern part was Soviet. The southern part was British. And we had sort of a part in the north central area, mm-hmm. in the Salzburg area. That was so, but the administrative headquarters was in Vienna. So the MPs went in one day, and we went, I think it was about the 7th, 6th or 7th of August of 45, we went in. We had to go through the Russian zone to get there. And as we were going into the Russian zone, we saw many Hungarians heading home. Some of them were riding bicycles. And they would catch on to the truck, so they didn't have to pedal the bikes going with us. And that's another thing we saw, the upheaval of the refugees. When we were in Innsbruck, we saw the Italians heading home to through the Brenner Pass. Anyway, we got in there. We were in Vienna. We first lived at a schoolhouse. And I know went up the top floor and I saw something. What was it? It was the, they have a giant Ferris wheel in, and I could see it in the distance, but I didn't know what it was. We stayed there a while. We finally moved to a place in what they call Vering. Then we moved to a palace in Nyvaldsheim, and the palace dated from about 1711. It had been actually, the property went back to the 1500s, mm-hmm. and it was a very beautiful, typical Austrian palace. We slept in a room, probably 40 of us on cots. We had fresco ceilings, and it was up at a. So, and I've been back, and it's really a quite a nice place. In fact, I've even seen it in a commercial on TV.
Have you really? That's great.
And I can tell you about that, but that's another story. Mm-hmm. We did things like prepare the parking lot at the headquarters. The headquarters in Vienna was called United States Forces in Austria. Mm-hmm. The army had set up in Europe United States Forces European Theater. But they just cut us, Austria was being a separate country, they made a separate headquarters. And Mark Clark, who had been the in charge of the Fifth Army, was given the became the commander of the United States Force in Austria. So we were actually there before Mark Clark moved into Vienna. So we had to help prepare the headquarters building, the parking lot, and so I understand now they have a parking garage under where we built the parking lot. Mm-hmm. There was another building next to the headquarters. This was a bank building where we had the headquarters. But there was another building called the Allianz building. And I didn't know what Allianz was. But now you'll see on TV, there's an insurance company. Actually, the insurance company was started in Germany. But when Hitler took over Austria, they moved the insurance company into Vienna as well as in Austria as well as in Germany. So they had the Allianz building there, which we also used as one of our buildings. Later, as time moved on, the troops were being sent home. I had only been there for a short time, so I had to stay. And others who had been through battle, they were able to go home. So my unit became a unit where they just ran through people to before they went home. Mm-hmm. I finally, they found out I could type, so they put me in the companies, and I typed morning reports and such as that, which wasn't a big task. Then as the unit went home, I was interviewed for the counterintelligence corps, but I didn't go there. Somebody said they wanted me at the headquarters for Vienna. It was called VAC, Vienna Area Command Headquarters. Mm-hmm. The building they used was known as the Petroleum Building. Austria had an oil cartel, and this had been their buildings, but we took it over and used it for the headquarters. we had a, the officers had an officer's mess there, mm-hmm. and one of our men who was a, his hobby was cooking, he took it over and ran the officer's mess, and he was very ingenious. He would take coffee grounds that he had used and take them to the countryside and trade them to the farmers because they didn't have coffee. Coffee was scarce, but they would want the coffee grounds, and he'd get fresh vegetables. Mm-hmm. So it, he was ingenious that way in
that's
doing things.
That's a good things. Way to do it, a lot of bartering.
That's the American ingenuity. Mm-hmm. And another thing I can tell, and this is, I mean, it's the way things were. I was in the dining room there one day, and the Austrian ladies were there. All of a sudden, many of them ran away into the kitchen from mm-hmm. the dining room. And I asked, one of them remained there, and I said, what did they, why did they run? A group of quartermaster soldiers who happened to be black mm-hmm. drove up in a truck outside. Mm-hmm. And she said, they've never seen a black person. Mm. And I don't think they were scared. It was just something, they had never seen a black man. Mm-hmm. So they headed to the kitchen. This is the way things were then. Mm-hmm. And particularly, we in our country had troubles, but over there they had never seen a black person. Hmm. And but of course, the quartermaster units were predominantly black.
How did you head home? Did you go through Germany or?
I will tell you that. But anyway, while I was in Vienna, I was given a pass to Paris, and I went for a 3-day pass to Paris. And I was supposed to fly, but the planes were grounded the day I left, so I went in the back end of a truck. And that was a story about going through there. I don't want to elaborate on that because there's too much else to tell. And so I took the train from Munich, went to Paris. I did fly back, flew from Villacoublay Air Base, airfield, to Salzburg, spent the night. Next day flew from Salzburg, stopped at Linz, and then we got to the Tulln Air Force Base in Vienna. Mm-hmm. Then I also took another trip. I went to England, and that was by way of Paris. And I was there for Holy Week, and on Tuesday in Holy Week, I was at St. Paul's Cathedral to hear the Passion According to St. Matthew by Bach. On Thursday, I was at, and I didn't realize all this, but I was there at Westminster Abbey when King George VI and his wife, Queen Elizabeth, the parents of the present queen, came for Maundy Thursday services and at Westminster Abbey. So I really lucked in a lot of things seeing.
Yeah.
I went back to Vienna, and on May the 8th or 9th, we had a parade in Vienna to celebrate the victory in Europe. The Americans had taken their helmets and shined them and chrome-plated them, and so when they came down the street, all you could see was glitter of sunshine. The Russians were there, and the French were there, and it was quite an event. By July, I had spent my time, so on July the 9th, I left Vienna and got on a train. Now, prior to that time, the soldiers that went home in boxcars, mm-hmm. just like we went to get there. They went home in boxcars. But any way you could get home, you would go. But the time I got, and by the way, I went down to the train station to see all some guys I'd worked with in Vienna Air Command headquarters, and they were going home. And there was one fellow who had a girlfriend, Miss Margaret. And when he left, he had left Miss Margaret. And he cried. Mm-hmm. And as the train moved out, we had many soldiers there who had been in the Rainbow Division.
Right.
And they were taught to salute the rainbow. And as the train moved out, just as the wheels turned, the most vivid double rainbow appeared in the sky. And one end of it was at the spire of St. Stephen's Cathedral, the most famous church in Austria. And it was just very emotional, very emotional. And the guys went crazy. They were going home, and here was the rainbow in the sky. But when I got ready to go home, they had train cars, and they had three triple-deckers cots mm-hmm. lining the there. So we left Vienna. When I was leaving, there's one fella, I saw him take his second duffel bag onto the train with him. And I thought, I saw him carrying a duffel bag. He was carrying a duffel bag. Well, I had known him in Vienna, and he had found a little boy. The little boy didn't know who he was or what he took to him. He wanted to bring that boy back to States with him. So he had him in a duffel bag. In a duffel bag. And that's the second duffel bag I saw. When he got on the train, I found he was this kid, probably 9 years old. He got him all the way to Bremerhaven, and the authorities found him and they kept him, which is sad. Anyway, that was part of the story. But when we got to Salzburg, we stopped to pick up more troops. And here was Joe Duke, who I'd been at Alabama with.
Right.
You know, and then I met some other fellows. And there was another fellow had been, he was at Auburn, and I picked up and knew him. Well, there was a fellow with him that had been at Auburn with him. His name was Benny, B-E-N-N-Y, that was Denny. He told me Benny got killed. So, you know, it was, things were falling in place. And so we rode the train for quite a few days, but we stopped for food, and we had our place to sleep. And we got to Bremerhaven. We were supposed to go on a certain vessel, and we were canceled. I ended up coming across on the Wilson Victory.
Mm-hmm.
It took us 10 days to get across. We left Bremerhaven. We came through the English Channel, and we came by and saw the White Cliffs of Dover, mm-hmm. and we saw Land's End. And it was July, so the weather was relatively warm. And I stayed out on deck most of the time and got windburned, but I was happy and glad to come home. On my birthday, which was the 29th of July, I would pull KP duty. There was another guy pulling KP duty, and he said it was his birthday also. But we arrived in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, when I got on the ship to come home, I was 19 years old. I was sent over at 18, but my train was cut short, so I was over in 5 months. So consequently, I didn't get the American Service Medal because I didn't serve long enough because you had to serve 6 months in the States. That's okay. So 2 days after my birthday, we landed in New York. We got there in the evening, and just as went by the Statue of Liberty, light came on. It was just great. We were welcomed home. And we stayed there, and for a short time they put us on a train. We went, and I know we went through Wilmington, Delaware, and I went by and saw a few blocks from where my aunts lived, and we went to Fort Bragg. We were processed at Fort Bragg for a few days and given physical and so forth. And so I thought I'd ride the West Coast Champion into Gainesville and have my folks pick me up there. But some of them said, well, there's an earlier train. So I took the earlier train, got to Jacksonville in the middle of the night and took the bus from Jacksonville, came to Gainesville. I said, I'll call my folks and tell them I'm here. I got here at the bus station. They said, there's a bus leaving to Trenton. So I jumped on the bus and called my folks the next morning. That morning, they didn't know I was home, but I was home. So that's it. Anything else? Well, I was home. It was like the 7th or 8th of August. I think it was probably the 7th or 8th. I found out, I thought, well, I'm just going to do nothing. Then I got to thinking about doing nothing, and I heard that the registration university was closing on the 15th of August. Well, here it was, I was killing time. And I said, do I really want to sit around and do nothing? So on the 14th of August, I was over here in Gainesville, registering for classes. And then I had to take tests, and it talked about sines and cosines. And I said, oh, do I remember this? Okay. Anyway, I was able to pass. I didn't have to take the math course because I had that at Alabama. And so I got into what they call the University College, and you may know about that.
Yeah.
Any more questions?
Well, How did the war change your life? How did the war change your life? In what ways do you think the war experience changed your life?
Well, the war changed my life in many ways even before I got in the Army. Mm-hmm. I was 13 years old when, I remember Hitler going into Austria. For some reason, that impressed me. When he took over Austria, that was 1938. But then when he went into Poland in 1939, I was 13 years old. So I say I was a teenager then, and when I stepped on the ship in Europe to come home, I was still a teenager. Of course, we knew about shortages. We knew about our classmates. Some of my classmates, I had known them in school, and they went to war, and we got word they got killed. So here we knew about some people we'd gone to school with that were killed. I had another classmate, her uncle was on a ship. I think it was the Gulf American, and that's well known. It's been well documented, and there's a lot of stories about it. Her uncle was a seaman on the ship. The ship was sunk by a German submarine off our coast of Florida. His body washed up on the shore at Jacksonville Beach. He was from my hometown, so they brought him home to Trenton, and they had his funeral, and I went to his funeral. Those are things we knew about and we experienced. We experienced the shortages of things. You couldn't get gasoline as often as you could, as other things. And food shortages. We had ration stamps and such as that. And on the coast, they had blackouts because of the submarines operating off the coast. We had aircraft warning systems, and I, as a student, would go out and man a post with another person, and we'd look for airplanes, and so we reported when a plane went over, we would chart it, and we'd call it in, and so those are things that affect us that way. So we already were conditioned for what war was like, and of course I'd heard my father talk about the First World War, and he had pictures of that and things that I knew about that. So I was sort of conditioned. I think it made me more serious. We didn't have the frivolities that young people today have of being, although things right now aren't that well either, yeah, in economically, and I'm even feeling it myself. But we went through a depression too, and I know my father, having sold jewelry, being in the jewelry business, well, people didn't buy jewelry, so he finally just folded up. He finally, and how we lived, I don't know. He finally got a job working with a surplus commodity program where the government bought agricultural products from the farmers, and when they were distributed to poor people, and so he got involved in that kind of a job. Later, he some fellow ran the was city clerk in the city of Trenton, and he found a job in Panama, tremendous pay. So he left his family and just took off to Panama to make this big money. So my father was offered the job.
You mentioned in the pre-interview that your father was pretty deeply affected by World War One. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I don't know exactly what happened. I know that when he came back, he said he always had headaches. He constantly had headaches. Now, whether he had those from that time or what, I don't know. But I know he told me one time he was someplace and he just passed out. And he said somebody, another soldier from a foreign country, just grabbed him and stood him up on his feet. As I said, I served a month. Maybe I didn't tell you that, but I told somebody else that today, that how long we were in the war. Well, I got over there in April, and the war, early in April, the war ended in May. And I thought, well, he was over there a long time, but he wasn't. He went over in September of 1918, and the war was over in early November. Mm-hmm. But during that time, they were in the trenches. I think the weather, they were bogged down in the mud. And I know that he saw people getting killed and so forth, and I don't know all about that, but I do know that he had pictures of their graves that he had, and one of them, I even was able to know who he was. His name was Manlove, and the I found out later through that he actually wasn't killed in the war. He was killed afterwards because he had a shell and was cleaning it because he was going to take it home as a souvenir. And the shell blew up and killed him. And there enough, when I looked at the graves, the pictures, he's the only one that had a fresh grave. All the others had grass growing on them. His just had dirt on it. Mm-hmm. And so the story came together. Yes, this is what happened. I think that now he said when he went in to enlist, they didn't take him at first. He said, okay, give me something in writing that you won't take me. And they said, no, they let him go, come in. That way he went with his buddies he knew. And he was in a unit from Delaware. He was from Delaware. So it was called the 59th Pioneer Infantry. Now, Pioneer Infantry is like they do combat, but they also do engineering work. In fact, the British and the Austrians call their engineers pioneers. So my father and I kind of served in the same kind of unit. he was supply sergeant, which was a rank at that time. Actually had a different sleeve, you know, on his sleeve. I don't know. I think that as a child, his mother and father both died, and he was put out on his own. He had an older brother who was married, and I think he saw him at times, but he had had sisters older and younger, and I don't know. He was put out sort of on his own, and I think that affected him also. And so he just was on his own, so to speak. I was nurtured in my family. It was just me. I had no brothers and sisters. As a student, I tried to study, and my father was, because he'd been in the war, he said he didn't want any part of hunting or fishing, and he didn't want me to play football. So there were certain things that I had to operate within that area. So it affected me in that way, but I handled it okay.
And he didn't want you playing football and hunting?
Because he thought I might get injured and hurt.
I understand. Okay.
So I was not into sports.
Talking about your post-war life, how did the war affect your career path and your post-war life? You were on the GI Bill?
Yes.
Okay.
When I was in high school, they said, you ought to come up with a career. Well, what did I want to do? I don't know. Well, I guess I was pretty good in math, and I was good in other things. I enjoyed history, but what are you going to do with history unless you're going to teach it? But I was relatively good in math, and I took bookkeeping, and so they came up with the idea, well, there's an accountant. So I said, okay, I'll try to be an accountant. And that's what I wrote in high school, that I'd be an accountant. Well, when I got to college, I majored in accounting. And I thought once when I was taking it, I like statistics. Well, I thought, well, could I major in statistics? So I said, no, I'll still stay in accounting. So I got an accounting, my degree was Bachelor of Science in Business Administration with a major in accounting. Got out of school. At that time, it was hard to get a job. I applied with several accounting firms. Well, what experience do you have? Well, we're only hiring people with experience. That was a story I got. I even talked about corporations. I even got a job, inkling of a job in Montana. Well, I'd never been to Montana. And they wrote me and said, I had the qualifications, but they had somebody in Montana they hired instead of me. I found it, so I knew a person that I had admired, and my father told me he's a person you should model yourself after, and he was an accountant. And he had worked for the state auditor, and so I had a lead there, so I went and talked to them, and I got a job with the state auditing department. And I first started to work in Jacksonville, and I first started on state audits, but they also audit the county. So they had the audit divisions of the county and state. Well, the county, all county officers are really state officials. They're commissioned by the governor, and they are state officials. So I actually got into working in the county, and I worked with schools, community colleges, and I got that was sort of my specialty. Mm-hmm. So I worked in Jacksonville, first at the Welfare Department, which is now called HRS, but then it was called State Welfare Board. I also audited at the state prison, where I had to go through three fences each day, auditing there. I worked at the military department in St. Augustine, and this was all done out of Jacksonville. But then I was transferred to, I had also done school board work in Jacksonville. And in fact, there was somebody there that we learned to use IBM punch card machines to aid us in audits, mm-hmm. which was quite enlightening because I had never worked with any such machines. Then I went to Bradenton in Sarasota and worked in that area. I worked in Tampa and Clearwater. And while I was there, they had started a tour of duty at the office in Tallahassee. So I went to a tour of duty there in 1957. And afterwards, I went to audits in Collier County, which at that time was the county seat was Everglades. Went to Key West. I ended up doing three tours of duty in Key West. And I did a tour of duty in Fernandina Beach in the meantime. And I've also worked in Mayo and Pensacola and went back to Tampa more than once. While I was in Key West the second time, I ordered the clerk of the court, of the criminal court there, and found out he was padding the jury payrolls.
Okay.
This was very interesting because he padded him in two ways. He padded him by adding names to the jurors who were fictitious people, and he also padded them by increasing the amount he actually paid them. So he was, and so actually I caught him. And so Governor Collins was governor at the time. He suspended him and he put him in jail. We heard that he had leprosy. So when he got out of jail, he came to shake my hand. So I shook hands with him. I think he wanted to sort of thank me for catching. I think he was under this burden. I'm doing something I shouldn't do. I finally caught, and I'm glad I'm caught.
Yeah.
So he wanted to show there was no hard feelings, so he came to shake my hand. Immediately, I went and washed my hands. So. And he did have leprosy, and they sent him to the, his sentence was to go to the leper colony. So the judge had someone take him to the leper colony.
Okay.
That's just a thing of
yeah.
my career. I also audited hospitals, and that was another story, too. And being a native Floridian, I love Florida. And, of course, my parents were from the north, and they took me home to see the family. And I went when I was 2 years old. My maternal grandfather died when I was three, and I remember going and seeing him lie in the casket. But I went back other times. I went back in earlier than that, but I went back in 1939. My father took me to the New York World's Fair, so I got to go to New York. They took me to Bessie Ross's home, where the first flag, the first flag, mm-hmm. went to Independence Hall.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Franklin Institute. We did at the planetarium, we did a trip to the moon. And I was televised in 1939. So I got some experiences of things. The young people that I grew up with in Trenton, many of them had never seen a house, a row house, or a two-story house. They lived on farmhouses. They brought biscuit and fat back with them to eat it because we didn't have a lunchroom. You had to take your own lunch or else went home for lunch. So those days were like that. We only had 8 months in school because we couldn't afford that. And because they grew watermelons, they wanted the children home earlier, so we went to school in August. So that's where I graduated in March. That's the kind of life.
Bob, can I ask you a question? What is the one thing that people forget the most about the Second World War?
I think today some people don't even know it existed. They know it was there, but they really don't know what it's about. Some people even know who was fighting whom. They don't realize it was such a global war. I think of it as Europe because that's where it was, but it was in Africa. It was in the Pacific. Of course, I remember Pearl Harbor. I was a friend's, we had neighbors that the man had worked for my father, and finally he went to to run a farm. So we're at his farmhouse when we heard the news about Pearl Harbor. And of course, I think this, of course, I went to Dachau. I saw what a concentration camp was like. There's some people that still say it didn't happen. Friend, one of them is running for office and to be reelected in Iran.
Right.
I don't know. I hate to say this, but after I got out and I got to working, I didn't keep up with what was going on, and I did not get the full impact of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. I did get the impact of the Korean War a little bit. I just started to work when the war broke out. And here I am. Wow. I was in war, now I'm back. We're at war again. And I may have told you this, but one of my roommates in college, he was from Jacksonville. He got a degree in civil engineering. He had more GI Bill time, so he got a degree in electrical engineering. And he got out of school at the same time I did. He had been with Patton in the armored divisions in Europe and experienced all that. And he said when he got back, next war, I want to be an officer. So he took ROTC at the University of Florida. He became an officer. He was called immediately. And the war started in 1950. That's the year we got out of college. Before Thanksgiving, he was dead. So that had an impact on me. To know that here a roommate of mine had gone through World War II and went to Korea and was dead. But as I say, then the Vietnam War came along, I knew about it. I knew that about French Indochina and about how France had had there. But I just sort of put it aside. But I realized that the guys that were there, it was terrible. It was the worst thing that they went through. And I went to the dedication of the Korean War Memorial in Tallahassee, and there were Vietnam veterans there. And I was able to shake their hand and say thank you. So I think people now are thinking of the times, and we should be thinking about Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where it is now and what's going on. And I have different views than some people that do about it. And I know we haven't done the best job. And maybe we shouldn't have done it, but I don't know.
Yeah. What's your overall opinion of war, having lived through?
Right.
What is your opinion on war, just in general?
On war?
Yeah.
Well, we shouldn't have wars. But as I've told others, you look at the Bible, and if you believe anything in the Bible, we have the tradition was that the first sons of Adam and Eve, Cain killed Abel. There was conflict from the very beginning. And you read other things in the Bible or other things of history. There were wars all the time. And people say there's rumors of war and there always will be war. And I don't know what we can do about it. It's not, in our lifetime, we have an imperfect world. And and I try to do the best I can, and I'm not doing the best I can, but I try to do, and I try to be compassionate, but I'm not as compassionate as I should be. I don't know the answer. If I had the answer, I wouldn't be sitting here in Okamic in Gainesville.
I think that's a good place to stop.
I'll be glad to talk on more. That's fine.
Is there anything else you'd want to add to that?
Well, I have a lot of things to show you, and I don't know if we record it, but maybe...
Why don't we do that, and then I'll just...
Okay, all right, okay.
I want to thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, too.
Yeah, thank you.
And I think you're doing a good job.